Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Hey, everyone. It's Asten Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your deep dive org core debate of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. The future's under fire. The past is gaining ground. Okay, I know it's weird to hear guitars at the beginning of podcast. I understand, but I hope you guys have been bearing with us through the guitars. That was Near to the Wild Heart of Life. That is the opening song from the new album by Japandroids of the same name. Why are we talking about Japandroids this week? We are talking about Japandroids and also the Menzingers, two different sorts of punk bands with new records that both kind of grapple with middle age or impending middle age, but in very different ways. I'm joined by the two biggest rock fans on the planet, New York Times pop music reporter Joe Coscarelli.
Here I am.
And special guest, first time on the podcast, Dan Ozzie, writer-editor from Noisy, and maybe the last real rock critic alive?
Oh, thanks.
I mean, does it feel that way sometimes?
It'll be the title of my book.
But it does feel that way. Yeah. I mean, Dan, if you haven't read Dan is a deeply committed thinker about all things rock music in 2017, which is not
Complainer
a thing.
Complainer is yeah, the word you're looking for.
But that's not a thing that a lot of people right, yeah. are anymore. And so when I knew we were talking about this, I knew we had to have you in the building.
Thanks. I'm glad three dudes can get together and talk about bro rock.
Seriously, it's safe times. It's safe times.
John, Joe, and Dan.
Yeah.
We couldn't get a Steve in here. No Brian's or anything.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. Joe, let's start with Japandroids, both because of the two bands, I think they're a little bit more legible, maybe, but also I think... Joe, you profiled them recently, so I feel like we can get a little bit of insight about what it's like to be mid-career, both in thinking and also in aesthetics.
Sure.
So talk to me about your experience with them. Who are Japandroids? Why are they here? And why is their molting interesting?
So Japandroids are a duo, a two-piece band, just guitar and vocals, and then a drummer, Dave and Brian, to add to our John, Joe, and Dan. They got started in Vancouver, where they're from. They're very nice Canadian boys, just exceedingly polite.
But fake punk. Sorry.
But they started... making 7-inch singles, just sort of thrashing, good time punk music, very happy, punk, sure, but also informed by Springsteen, Tom Petty, a little bit Husker Du, a little bit Replacements. These are the names that sort of get thrown around most when thinking about this band.
And very their music, certainly up until the new album, very taut, concise, like very dynamic.
Yes.
Not very interesting necessarily, but very dynamic.
Fast songs, usually two lines maybe chanted over and over
lots
again.
Lots of woes and yes.
Lots of woes, yes,
lots
fist
of fist
pumps.
Yeah.
Rolled up white t-shirts, just some good time rock and roll dudes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the short version of their story is that they were kicking around local scene for a while, sort of ready to hang it up. They were going to make a debut album and then, like, get real jobs or continue on with their other real jobs. And, you know, one of their songs sort of caught on. The song Young Hearts Spark Fire, Pitchfork posted it, and they said basically, you know,
best new track
that saved their career, basically. You know, then they become a little buzzy. The album Post Nothing, 2009, I believe, you know, gets a lot of critical attention, and their live shows start to become, like, you know, pretty well known across the country. They tour like crazy. It's always sweaty. It's always beer. It's always dudes high-fiving. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel like the Japandroid shows that I went to in like the 2011, 2012 window were like among the sweatier shows
I've
been to.
Yes, definitely sweaty.
And it is that combination of like extreme testosterone, but also male intimacy happening at the same time.
I haven't really written too much about Japandroids, although I'm a big fan, but I did run a piece on Noisy yesterday by Ian Cohen, another rock writer, and he described their music so perfectly. He called it locker room talk inverted, you know, where it was just like, instead of like bragging about the chick you slept with last night, it's like talking about like, I'm really scared of the future, bro. You know, like I have serious feelings about the state of, you know, this country, bro.
So in 2012, Japandroids then sort of hit their apex, or what a lot of people would consider their apex. They put out an album called Celebration Rock. It's a great album. It's sort of the culmination of what their live shows had been building towards. Mm-hmm. It's extra anthemic, even more yes and woes in the songs.
Still sticking with those eight song, like just enough, like 25-minute long.
Yes.
Moist and muscle.
So that's the other thing about Japandroids is that they're very set in their principles. All of their albums, eight songs, about 30 minutes, a little more than half an hour of music, maybe. Side A and Side B, designed for vinyl. Covers in black and white, just a photo of the band, simple text. You know, they're sort of...
Never add another player on the live show. It's just two of them always.
The two of them, make a lot of noise. They're just real students of rock and roll, you know,
as it once was.
Right. They, you know, they love the Stones, they love Iggy Pop, they're sort of modeling their albums after the way that those albums would flow on vinyl in the 70s, you know. They don't license any of their music, which they make a big point about in the story that I wrote.
A wild, irrelevant stance in 2017. Right. Shouts to also, like, you know, remind me of Sturgill Simpson.
Sure,
like,
you know.
But also just not a position that is going to have a lot of cachet.
Sure. And they signed to Anti, the record label for this album, after putting out their first two on polyvinyl. And they said, you know, in the conversations with the label, they were sort of like, you know, we don't do social media. We're not really into tweeting. We're not into Facebook. We don't license our songs. And they said the Anti people were like, yeah, we work with Tom Waits. Like, we get
<We're> good.
Like, it's going to be okay.
So the new record, here's why the new record is different. We'll just start off with that. Starting point, songs are longer. Songs are more complicated.
Yes.
Feelings are a little bit deeper.
Little less sing-along.
Yeah,
too.
Less reliance on the chanting and on the bro energy.
A lot of lyrics. A lot of
like damn near Titus Andronicus.
Almost Titus Andronicus.
And also something that Ian pointed out in that aforementioned essay was that in the last one, Celebration Rock, it takes like halfway through for the word I to come up, and they only use it two times. And whereas it's like first verse of this entire album. So like that was very much a record where it was like, we're going to do this. Like, we're going to take over the world.
Celebration Rock is a Wii record.
Yeah, it's a Wii record. But
we're
this
drinking,
is the first,
we're smoking.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
The opening
but
track.
This is the first one. This like they got right to I, you know, and it like... It doesn't feel as much like you're in on it with him, I guess.
And there's an interesting, we'll get to this, there's an interesting reverse parallel to the Menzingers that we'll get to on this. So this record, to me, is less successful. I know, Joe, I know you like it.
I do.
To me, it's less successful. The thing that I'd been very intrigued by about Japandroids is this kind of deeply reduced, I don't want to say id, because it's not quite id, but deeply reduced sentiment distilled down into TK chords, TK chants, and like, boom, we're out. And bands always get more ambitious, and that's fine. But this was definitely a moment where I was like, "This is what I enjoyed most about this band was that the ambition was focused into a very specific thing,
totally,
not sprawl."
And I think that they knew that they were going to face this criticism.
It's also been 5 years.
Sure.
So it's not like they're just punching records out. Like, they've had time to think about it.
So what the drummer, Dave, said to me about, you know, this very thing, and it was basically when they toured behind Celebration Rock for almost 3 years, you know, and then they get home and it's time to unwind, and the very first conversations they start to have about making a new album touch on the fact that they don't want to do what they did on Celebration Rock and Post Nothing again, that they had, you know, they had maxed out, they had perfected it to some degree, and that if there was a knock on them, it was, you know, these guys are really fun, these guys are great at what they do, but they pretty much only do one thing, and they wanted to start challenging themselves to do something else. Now, that's why, you know, you get a little growing pains, obviously, when a band tries to do that. And in the meantime, you know, they're these nice Vancouver boys. The singer, Brian King, he moves to Toronto, to the other side of Canada. He starts spending time in Mexico City. He's traveling a lot. He's reading a lot. He's
taking in new inputs.
Yeah, and you know, he's
soaking up game.
He's over 30 now, and his life
heavens.
And so that's why I think, you know, they go into writing this record, which they meet back up at some point after taking some time off after the tour back in New Orleans, and they get back together and start trying to write this album, and they're just convinced that it should not sound like Celebration Rock. Right. Now, I think it's overstated a little bit. It's still, if you hear, you know, the song we played at the start of this is probably the one that sounds closest to Celebration Rock,
sure.
the first song on the album. But there are other songs that you could probably confuse a person on which album they were on or not. And then there are the ones that are much different.
Arc of Bar.
Arc of Bar is the real different one. This is a 7-minute song. It's built around a keyboard loop. Maybe we should play a little bit.
Let's play some Arc of Bar. Not all 7 minutes, but some of it.
So that's Arc of Bar, and that's sort of the band pushing itself to its, you know, outermost limits in terms of songwriting and sound. You know, it's some people seem to like it. Some people seem to be put off by it. I saw them at the Knitting Factory when they first announced that this album would be coming out, and it was really sort of amazing to watch, because their live shows, as we said, are these celebratory sort of sing-alongs, and everyone's chanting together. And then, of course, they had new songs to play.
They were also that was such a weird show because they were so trepidatious about it. Like, it was becoming comical. Like, between every single song that they played that was a new song, which I would say was about five songs in their set list, Brian would be like, guys, like, oh, I'm so glad everybody's here. We've been working on this record so hard, and we know you guys don't know the songs, but we're so excited to play them, and we really hope you like the record. Like, we worked so hard, and we really hope that you like it. And he said that before every single new song.
Like I said, these guys are very Canadian.
Yeah.
But he did, I'll say he did drop to the Back to the Future quote at some point, where he was like, you guys might not really
like this
song, but your kids are going to love it.
Dan, what's your vibe on this record? We talked a little bit before we started recording about the kind of the weird intrusion of Japan, like how Japan has kind of crash landed into some of these conversations a few years ago. So let's maybe talk about that to start with, and then kind of how this record jives with that.
Yeah, well, I was thinking, like, I've listened to this a bunch, and it really, besides that single, which I think is just a fantastic single, this record has not stuck on me yet.
Yeah.
Whereas Celebration Rock, I feel like I remember that sticking on me instantly. Mm-hmm. And so whether what I think of it, I think is fairly irrelevant, but I'm thinking of like what it might do to their careers. And like, you know, I understand that they wanted to do something different, but Celebration Rock, they had to have been in a weird place because Celebration Rock got them this whole new audience of fans because it was so amazing. And I understand that they don't want to do that again. However, like, is this new record going to like get them a lot of new fans? I don't know. I think a lot of their fans...
Or is it just going to dissatisfy?
I think they're still just going to be like going off what they built on Celebration Rock. Now, if they had done that same record again, it probably would have netted them the same thing. Like, they probably found all the fans that they were going to with Celebration Rock. I doubt doing it again would have netted them any more. So, I don't know.
Fair,
they were kind of rocking a hard
place. You know,
place.
They did find a lot of fans. And one of the things we talked about is, you know, they realized that Celebration Rock had a very long tail, that even
well,
after
lasted them
they
5
were done,
years yeah
but
yeah.
even after they were done touring, they would say, you know, we would hear from people who didn't even see us on those tours because they had only discovered the album after. Mm-hmm. And they were still gaining new fans from it, and you know, they're playing Terminal 5 here in New York. They sold out, like,
my favorite venue.
Yeah, well, literal, that's favorite. That's another podcast altogether.
Oh my god. All right, so one of the things that we're talking about in this tension about the new record is, how does a band whose existence and success is predicated upon a certain kind of youthful energy, a joie de vivre, how does that band approach maturity and middle age? And so that's the other reason we're talking also about the Menzingers today. So let's actually listen to the single from the Menzingers album, which is the new Menzingers album. It's called After the Party, and the single is called Lookers. That was Lookers by the Menzingers, and if you wanted to know what it is like to have your body, heart, mind, and soul decay in real time over a 4/4 punk production, that's what that sounds like. Menzingers are from Scranton and have been putting out records for about a decade, and a thing that I have appreciated about the records that they've put out to date is how consistent they are and how unconcerned with the larger conversations that people like us basically get paid to pay attention to. And Dan, a thing we were talking about, again, before we started recording, is how in the same way that Japandroids kind of crash landed into these conversations 5 years ago when they put out their sort of magnum opus, the Menzingers also put out a magnum opus 5 years ago, yeah. But it came from an entirely different direction.
Yeah, totally.
It bubbled up as opposed to crash landing down.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, the Menzingers and Japandroids definitely have a lot in common. Like, right, they both... within a couple months of each other in 2012, put out what many people will just forever consider their benchmark album, On the Impossible Past.
Right, so we're talking about On the Impossible Past from 2012.
And then they both put albums out this year. And the
Menzingers had one in between.
Right, the Menzingers put one in between. Yep. They had one in 2013, I think, 2014.
Yeah, 14, I think.
But, you know, the difference is, like, for me anyway, like, I follow, like, punk hardcore stuff pretty...
yeah.
Closely, so I know where the Menzingers were coming from.
Yeah, get us
that,
in the dirt.
That
man.
Was
Let's go in the dirt.
Menzingers, and I mean, like, I can hear them and be like, oh, that's Hot Water Music. That's Against Me. That's stuff that was on Punk News. You know, that's where they come from. They come from that scene. Totally get that. But for me, when I heard Celebration Rock, I don't even remember where I heard it, but I was like, I don't know where this came from.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we were talking about them being aliens before. Like, that literally could have just dropped from the face of the sky, and I don't know where that came from.
And the,
like,
band is very aware of that, and they know that it's been sort of oddly a boon for their career, because I think, you know, throughout the early 2000s, there were a lot of bands that sort of became known as pitchfork bands, quote-unquote,
yeah.
Or bands that were tied very closely to certain scenes, like if you think of, like, Arts and Crafts and Broken Social Scene,
yeah,
and
sure,
the whole Toronto
sure.
thing that was going on, or, you know...
oh, my God, what?
Or,
I'm sorry.
Or even, like, like the Shins making it off of, like, Garden State.
Joe,
and, like,
do you want me to make it to the end of the podcast?
You know, I'm just saying, just time and place bands. And Japandroids, you know, they come from distant Vancouver. They weren't really coming up with... peers, with direct peers, and they just and I think that's why the gaps between their albums sort of worked for them, and they could come back at different points in music and sort of still be doing the same thing.
There was a part in your Japan Droid story that I actually thought applied more to the Menzingers, which is, I think, I forget who it was, but they talked about bands that do a very kind of like distilled thing.
Right.
You know, the Ramones, AC/DC. Yeah. And to me, like, the blue collarness of that very much resonates from the Menzingers. Because when you listen to every Menzingers record up until this one, I keep thinking, I mean, in blue collar, I don't mean it in a pejorative way at all, but it is like, we have a job. Our job is to make this kind of punk record, and we're just going to do it every year. We're going to put out a record for 2 years and be good at it. And it's refined. It's a refined product, but it is not a, it's not a elegant or even particularly ambitious product. And that's something, and we had talked a little bit before about, they don't really get a lot, as much press attention. Mm-hmm. And they're, you know, they don't come from a world.
Yeah, well, I mean, we were talking about how, you know, again, like their 2012 album On the Impossible Past, largely considered by fans as like being their just masterpiece. And it is front to back. Perfect record. I mean, it is unbelievable. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you would never see the Pitchfork cover that.
Mm-hmm.
And like watch somebody.
Certainly
pull
the Pitchfork of 2012. The Pitchfork.
Yeah,
maybe,
never.
Yeah, today.
And to me, it's funny because like everybody's always having these conversations about rock is dead, rock is dead, indie rock is dead. And like, yo, this rock band out of Scranton just put out a perfect rock record. And it's so weird too, because you were talking about like Broken Social Scene and the Shins. Mm-hmm. And I feel like what killed indie rock, or at least the notion of indie rock, right, is that indie rock, people tend to associate it with a time and a place. That mid-2000s, like, band after band after band just selling a lot of records. The Shins.
Arcade Fire.
Soft AF.
Garden State Rock, right? So when people think of indie rock, they think of that sort of Garden State soundtrack type of rock, even though, like, there's nothing independent about it. They're selling thousands and thousands and thousands.
And there was also nothing particularly original about that moment.
So we're calling that indie rock. So I think when people get that in their head, like, okay, that's what indie rock was. And now we're in 2017, and people are like, well, indie rock is dead. And what they mean is there's no more of the Shins type bands. But if you want to look at independent rock, indie rock, like, here's two bands who are on independently run labels. They're both actually on the same parent label and
Epitaph.
Right,
the new Menzinger records is on Epitaph.
And, like, they're playing, you know, like, Menzingers come to town, they play Webster Hall, which is not as big as Terminal 5, or they play Bowery, which is a 1,000-person venue. I mean, like, what do you want? Like, these are indie rock bands. And they're making good records, and they're doing very well.
So that brings up two things I want to talk about. The first one we'll do quickly, and the second one then we'll follow. The first one is the narrativization of what an indie rock band is. Because a group like the Menzingers doesn't fit into, let's say, a publicist-driven narrative of indie rock. It ends up falling by the wayside. And I imagine now that they're on Epitaph, you know, like the last, say, 3 years of the Menzingers, I imagine there are people who are catching up on them who just have no context for the punknews.org days.
Oh, yeah, sure. They don't care about that. Pitchfork has no interest in that.
Talk to me just for a sec, to sidebar quickly. What is it that you think about the music of the Menzingers? Forget the words, but the music that actually, because I feel like that's probably the thing that separates it from a lot of those other bands, is their commitment to form.
Interesting. Yeah. What like breaks the mold for them?
Yeah, or not even breaks the mold, but like, what to me, it's really like they just woodshed it and really practice hard on a particular idea.
You know, like, it's funny because like our whole career as writers supposed to be like telling people what differentiates music, but sometimes, like, you know, you just listen to something and you're like,
know.
That's it. That's different. The lyrics, I feel like, are very good. It borders on cheesy in a good way sometimes. Also, it is, like we were talking about, sort of like a lot of drinking bro rock. But then again, like, you know, my best friend Tammy, like, that's her favorite, like, one of her favorite bands, the Menzingers. So it's not exclusive to dudes, you know. But
some women, there's some women at these shows.
At least three.
Like, I'm just saying, like, I know like a ton of women who love the Menzingers. So like, while I definitely would say that thematically super bro rock, it also definitely like doesn't get pinned into that corner, you know? But then also, like, you know, I was reading your review on thenewyorktimes.com.
Yeah, there, there you go. Go click that link. And like smash
one,
that like.
One thing that you, I mean, I agree with you on a lot of it, but one point that I kind of was like, I don't know if I agree with that, is when you said that this new record was where they kind of matured, or like they seemed older, or like more wise. But to me, like the band always, especially starting with On the Impossible Pass in 2012, was always like this old soul type of nostalgic band.
Yeah,
like
I think that's
you know
fair.
Like the whole record of On the Impossible Pass is like, remember when we used to like I used to pick you up from work and we would get high. Remember when we used to drink behind the diner. Remember when we would drink coffee in the diner. It's Gaslight Anthem, you know.
Right. So and you said those Japan three droids. Words. I'm glad you said them because I didn't want to have
early
to say
Japan Droids has that too, but it's sort of like a to me in both bands, it's like a young person's idea of nostalgia. And it's
right.
Like,
right. Yeah. You're not gonna have a 75-year-old man reading that. And be like, what are you talking about?
No, it's the wisdom. 25-year-olds
being like, remember when we were 18.
And this is to go back to what you were saying about the I versus we of Japandroids. I reread my review of the last Menzinger's record, and I had completely forgotten what I'd written about it. And what I wrote about it was that 7 of the 12 songs start with I.
Mm.
That was like the first sentence of that review. And there's almost, I don't want to say there's no I on this record, but it's not as immediate. And I think that's when I was listening to Lookers and a bunch of the records like Bad Catholics and Your Wild Years. Like, that seems like someone who's lived through something and is comparing the now and the then, whereas the wisdom of the last two Menzinger's records was, I'm in the now, but I'm smart enough to understand the future.
Mm-hmm.
And this feels like a slight turn towards the like, did I screw up? Am I a failure?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing that very struck me. And again, that the lack of I, like the I-ness of the last album is so like, I'm here, damn it. And this is a little bit more like, I was there. And now I'm thinking about it and kind of regretting, or at least sometimes regretting, the part. Let's listen to one more Menzinger song. Let's listen to Bad Catholics.
But thank God for your father's last name and all the connections that he's made to everyone. You're such a sweet church girl, but I know your secret.
Okay, so that was Bad Catholics, also from the new Menzinger's record. The second thing, I had said before, there were two kind of spin-off things I wanted to talk about. The second thing is about how masculinity moves in indie rock. And, you know, we talk about that era, the mid-2000s era that we were talking about before. You talk about the softness of it. You talk about the approachability of it. It is not a particularly testosterone-influenced time.
Remember the Fleet Foxes? That was a band.
The Mewling Fleet Foxes?
Or even the first Bon Iver album, I think, was part of that whole thing. You know, there was a gentle moment there.
And I also think like that kind of whatever that energy was also present in, you know, the Brooklyn Warehouse scenes. Like this energy didn't feel like it was there until all of a sudden it kind of was there. And I'm sort of wondering if what was happening in 2012 as the Japandroids were crash landing and Menzingers were kind of elevating out of the scene into like a slightly wider renown, is if that in and of itself was a backlash against some kind of energy that was missing in indie rock at the time.
I mean, neither of those bands, like, I just want to say that, like, as far as gender politics or, you know, masculinity goes, like, I don't think either of those bands are, like, again, like, just talking about some of the hardcore that's out there that's, aggressive, you know, like...
They're not on the far
None of those
end.
Bands... Yeah, actually, like...
Just a little scuzzy.
Just a little scuzzy, greasy. Like, talking about kissing girls, you know, like... And it's funny because I feel like just with... The environment in which music exists, which is this, like, think piece, like, is this person capital letter bad, you know?
Right.
Like, because they're writing about dumping a girl or whatever, you know? And, like, I feel like those bands, like, were like, hey, we would politely like to write about women in a way that, you know, like, maybe we don't come off as the best guys in the world, but like we're admitting to our faults, where it's just like, it's not like they're not love records. They're almost just like acknowledging, like, I'm a scumbag, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah. I mean, they're not like going to play the black and blue ball, you know, like they're not coming from that.
And those, and I think the first when these more bar bandy type dudes were coming up after the softer period we were talking about, I think like the Hold Steady and Gaslight Anthem, who you mentioned, who the Men Singers sound a lot like. And then there's even like a next generation, like the Men Singers are idols to a band like Modern Baseball, which is another Philly sort of maybe more emo pop punk and less bar bandy, less punknews.org, but children of that, and they sort of deal with relationships in a similar way, I think, in maybe a little bit more millennial.
They're very mindful of you know, everybody that will be listening to their music. Will put, you know, they will very much are mindful of being inclusive, which is very cool.
Sure.
Joyce Manor fall on
this
at all?
Yeah, I think they're involved. But John, I wonder what you think about the fact that as these bands have sort of, you know, risen and then maybe coasted, the real sort of excitement in punk and indie rock have been in like female bands.
Oh, for sure.
That's the sort of unspoken elephant in the room is when we talk about the death of rock and roll or how maybe indie rock isn't in the zeitgeist or, you know, no rock bands are on the charts, that's for sure. Well, with the exception of 21. Bands that don't really play guitar, like 21 Pilots and the 1975. But in the underground, it's all
women. So, Joe, you're talking the Crutchfields, you're talking Bully, you're talking Dilly Dally, Pedal.
That's what annoys me about, like, when we talk about those sort of indie rock is dead thing pieces. You know, like, I read one on MTV.com, and I might be just paraphrasing, but, like, I remember it being like, indie rock is dead because it's all white dudes, and look, it's Dive and, like, two other bands. And so, like, well, yeah, if you look at Dive, of course you would think it's dead.
Yeah,
like,
sure.
What about Hop Along? What about, like, all these bands that have rad women or people of color in them? Like, we're totally
Downtown
ignoring
Boys.
That. Yeah, like, and it's weird because those bands do well, but then they, like, cap out at a certain level. And I don't want to be, like, conspiracy theory and, like, oh, we're keeping them down. But, like, why can't those bands break past that level when they deserve to?
I mean, like, I wonder a lot about – it's like, for example, I was very gratified to see Alison Crutchfield's solo record coming out on Merge. Mm-hmm. So I feel like Merge is a label that really, even I would say as recently as a couple years ago, was primarily promulgating a sound that felt very like late 90s and early 2000s. And I think like them being willing to take a flyer and sign Alison and put out this new record, which doesn't really sound like swearing. It's a little bit, I don't know quite how to describe it. I think it's a little
singer, it's more singer-songwriter.
But it's also like, I feel like sonically it's, you know, experimental is a bad word, but I feel like she's attempting song structures that she was not attempting in swearing. But the idea that that record is on Merge, to me, is a sign of hope. Because I feel like a lot of what we think of as like heritage indie rock labels continue to serve middle-aged white male customers. Mm-hmm. And I think
putting out the ninth album by the singer for a band.
Right,
that was
which like, you know, sorry, yawn, pass, moving on. But I feel like as whether it's new labels coming along to kind of address the Bandcamp generation, or whether these labels kind of adjust themselves, like maybe like a way a Sub Pop has, and just sort of like reinventing yourself every 18 months, maybe that will change. But I do think what's happened is indie rock got codified, and then that set of tastemakers remained in place, and they continue to scratch their old itches. Now, that said, I'm perfectly happy to go on, you know, I'm perfectly happy to find those bands, you know, like I didn't need Waxahachie to sign to somebody to find it interesting. And I think ultimately people who are paying close attention don't need
that.
But
when you talk about the narrativization of all of this, that's what you're sort of missing when all of this is spread out and you don't get the pieces about scenes or about labels.
But the thing that I also forget, and this is like a very, I'm probably blinding myself to this, but like, the fan bases for like that ninth record by such and such singer songwriter or band from the early 2000s, that fan base is there.
Oh yeah.
That's a real viable business. Yeah. So if you were in that real viable business, it wouldn't serve your narrative interest to say, actually, that's not where the heat is. The heat is actually in this other place. But we should all be writing more, like there's literally way more interesting stuff happening with women in punk.
But
right
you
now
know, also men. Like we were talking, you were talking earlier about just this idea that people keep saying that like rock is dead and rock is dead. And I think a lot of times what people mean by rock is dead is that there's no band under the age of 45 who hits Billboard charts or play stadiums. Like everybody that's above
or
that.
Or influences sort of right. mainstream culture.
Everybody
culture. Culture.
Is above that. Green Day, Metallica, mm-hmm. Foo Fighters. These are all old guys, mm-hmm. you know? And so like, why is it that like we can't let the next person break that level? And I don't know why, but I always use Hopalong as an example, just because I'm such a big fan of them. And
tell
and
the
of,
people who Hopalong
yeah,
are.
Speak
in case
Hopalong
they don't
know. Is a band from Philadelphia, and it is.
You only know, listen to Philadelphia.
I do pretty much. Yeah.
But they, you know, there's a brother and sister in a band, Mark on drums and Francis on vocals, and you know, like they put out these weird, amazing records, and they have a big fan base that seems to get larger and larger. And Francis is somebody that I watch, and I'm just like in awe. And I'm like, if this was 1976, you would be Janis Joplin.
And they've got hooks.
They've got hooks. Yeah, and like, I remember Mark Hoppus from Blink-182 once tweeting out one of their songs and saying, this is the best pop song ever written. And I'm like, you know what? It is. It's the song Tibetan Pop Stars, if you look it up. But then you're just like, okay, so why can't you break that level? Is it the gatekeepers of like, you can't get on Colbert or Conan, or like you're not playing TV, or you're not playing the bigger slot at festivals. Like, what is preventing you from really breaking that out? Are you not like playing bigger shows? Is it like, you know, like, and I always just wonder because I'm not smart enough to know like what it is.
You have a few ideas?
Yeah. One of the main things is that rock radio doesn't really exist anymore.
Yeah.
And radio is still, you know, for as much as streaming is, you know, the future of the industry, radio still plays a big role in breaking artists, and labels, you know, are pushing to radio, and it's a cycle. And if you're not getting played on the radio, it's really hard to sort of crack the upper echelons of the Billboard chart, you know, outside
Pilots.
Of your, unless you're 21 Pilots, which can get played on pop radio because it's not guitar based.
It's basically an EDM.
1975, band. Same thing. These are dancey songs that can get played on pop radio. The other thing is rock fans, as of yet, just don't really stream with the power that that hip hop and R&B mm-hmm. fans do. And the way the charts are weighted now, with where streams are factored in. The rock bands just aren't getting any juice off of it.
Right.
That.
I mean, and the obvious undercurrent to all of that is what happened in 1997, which is hip hop came in and put a foot in the ass of rock music.
Yes.
And like pop has not, basically anyone in terms of shaping dominant ideology about pop, there isn't, you can't really identify a rock band of the last 10 to 15 years that's done that.
I also have a quick theory about this too, is that I think the internet has
never heard of it. Can you tell our listeners?
Yeah, it's
about
like
the
a series of tubes that Al Gore invented. But I think the internet made everything so individual focused. Right in 1993, 1992, we cared about Nirvana the band. If there was Twitter in 1992. Would you follow Chris Novoselic? No, you would follow Kurt Cobain, which is why I think that like rock, which is band oriented, has really lost its muster because like people want the front man or woman, you know, like they. And so now we can just follow who we want. So what motivation is it to play in a band? Like you want to be a celebrity yourself. Mm-hmm. And like, I don't know, maybe what rock needs is for the next Joe Strummer, the next Kurt Cobain, the next Joan Jett to just kick the door open and just be like, this person's a superstar.
I'm going to throw out a name. Haley Williams.
Yo!
Paramore's coming back this year. Fingers crossed.
Oh, my God.
Call me Paramore.
Seriously. Hit us in the DM.
You know,
something.
And I'll say that they were an example of a band that sort of came out of pop punk emo sound and scene and did hit pop radio. And I think they came on the heels of bands like Fall Out Boy and Panic at the Disco, who were the last ones to cross over in that way. And it was interesting when I was writing about Modern Baseball last year, one of their friends and early fans who ran an emo blog said like, you know, that there were a lot of bands around that time when Fall Out Boy hit that were getting signed as soon as they formed, and then they were opening in arenas and they never really came up through scenes. just, and the, you know, a similar thing that you saw happen with grunge, where, you know, people saw there was a little bit of a gold rush with emo style pop punk bands, and that killed the scene a little bit, because
I feel like the counter narrative to that, though, is there are sometimes bands who are so reliant on scene and so local and specific that they don't translate in the same way. And like, this is a little bit of a left field thing for this particular conversation, but like, I think a lot about how merchandise came into the world and how it was presented, and then how
merchandise the band
yes, and how they were presented, and then how they basically tried to scale, and it didn't scale. It just very simply didn't scale. It was weird, because like, it's the type of narrative that for people like us, we'd be like, oh, that's like exactly the story we want, like something that's like an authentic representative of a weird place, and then like maybe 10 million people will like
but
it.
But I think Japandroids, Menzingers, Modern Baseball have been a little more conservative in that they haven't signed to a major label. What they've done instead is continue to make records, play the same cities over and over again, play a little bit bigger of a venue every time, and then you do end up in a Terminal 5, even if you're not on the radio or MTV.
Well, you know what? There's also a downside to what we're talking about too, which is that like, we're all like, oh, why can't rock bands get bigger? And then, though, there's that thing where, like, even if a good band makes it big, you see into the future of what is
it's going to ruin it.
At, like, Refuse, Shape of Punk to Come. You're like, oh, I got this. Yeah. I get what you're going for. But then you're like, oh, wait. I'm looking 10 years into the future, and I see Crazy Town covering, you know, Can I Scream? And like,
that actually
like,
sounds fire. I'd like to hear that.
Did that happen?
No, you do not. Like, look it up on YouTube.
Is that a real thing?
Oh, yeah. So, you know, like, that's what you're looking ahead to. So, like, with every band that, like, makes it, it's just, like, opening the door for just, like, the worst copycat.
Not to mention the fans being mad, because we saw that with a band like Against Me, which, you know, came up from a very specific punk
scene. Very familiar with Against Me.
And then...
Yes, that's true.
Can I plug my book?
Yeah, of course you can.
I wrote a book with Laura Jane Grace from Against Me. Yeah. If you'd like to read that.
Well, tell us the name.
It's called Dranny, which is a very terrible name.
It came out a few months ago.
Yeah. I mean, like, that's a great example of a story where, like, they definitely took the opportunity where there was this fire brewing of like, oh, people are kind of interested in this sound, and they kind of represented like, oh man, that's the band that perfected it, let's sign them.
Yeah.
And they, you know, major label took a chance on them, Sire Records, and it didn't work out, you know, like they, I mean, to say it didn't work out, they in their first week or 2 weeks or whatever, they sold 100,000 copies,
right,
which is like fantastic, right, you know, for a label, they want $500,000. They want $1 million.
But then they did something interesting, which is they basically retreated back and still made similar records.
But what's funny, though, is that, like, that story is what could happen and has happened to so many bands, where it's just like, chuck a shot, didn't work out, you're Jawbreaker, you're gone now.
Right.
But Against Me, if they didn't have this crazy story of their front person transitioning into a woman and like writing this unbelievable record about it, that just like a milestone record, like that band would have been kaput too, you know? So like,
as a Florida Against Me fan from the beginning,
are we trying to out Against Me right now? Like,
who abandoned them in the middle.
Me too.
And I would say that you're exactly right.
And I've told Laura that to her face too.
I'm sure she knows.
I'm like, hey, just FYI, like, I don't really like New Wave. And she'll just go, okay. Yeah. You know, like, what are you going to do about it? Yeah. You know, but like, it really wasn't like a label thing. It was just like, oh, I feel like your sound got compromised here. And that's the other risk, too, that a band runs, when it's just like, whenever they get some success.
Whenever Butch Vig produces
your record? Whenever they get some success.
I don't know if Butch Vig actually produced that.
He did.
Straight guess.
But that's always the risk. And that was like, I feel like if you could search the comments of punk news, the most common word I bet you would find in the reviews is overproduced.
Yes.
Right, that's always the thing that people want to pin to like a band that gets a shot.
Yes.
It's just like, I don't like this, it's overproduced.
Yeah.
Happened to every single band that ever came up, you know.
I feel like after this very, very heavily male conversation, like, maybe we should go out with some female punk.
Yeah, let's
should
do
we
it.
Listen to an Alison Crutchfield song.
That'd be great.
All right,
I like Dean's Room.
Yeah, let's do that. Alison Crutchfield, Dean's Room, Long Live Female Punk. I get on the mattress on the floor. I've never been addicted to anything like this before. I dance around in Dean's room while I have it to myself. Thank you for listening to the New York Times podcast. Thank you to my guests, Joe Coscarelli, Dan Ozzy. Shouts to all our friends at Noisy, Eric, Lawrence, Kim. Anybody else you want to shout out at Noisy?
Oh, shout out to Annalise. What's up, Annalise?
Everybody, it's a fair open space on podcasts. Everybody gets love. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. You can email us about your favorite orgcore bands at podcast at nytimes.com. You can read me on the Menzingers, Joe on Japan Droids, and Dan on all sorts of punk at nytimes.com/music. Our producer is Vanessa Romo, and we want to say heartfelt thanks and good wishes to our longtime producer, Jocelyn Gonzalez, who is off to brighter climes at WNYC. We will miss her, and we wish her all the best. Come check us next week.
When your space has the long-lasting, noticeable scent of Airwick Vibrant Scented Oils, you'll want to invite everyone over, from book club to the fantasy league, even the in-laws.
It smells amazing.
Airwick Vibrant Scented Oils are infused with 2 times more natural essential oils versus regular Airwick Scented Oils for our most authentic, nature-inspired fragrance experience. Transform your space with scents like white sage and mahogany or lavender and water lily. Now that's a breath of fresh Airwick.